Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
I always say that we have special guests on Crossover, and here's another one. His name is Robert McFarland. He's a dramatic baritone, and I actually met him at a concert, and I was so delighted to make his acquaintance that I invited him to come on Crossover and tell us about his wonderful career and his life. Robert, welcome to Crossover.
Good to be here.
You are a dramatic baritone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You won the Metropolitan Opera auditions in 1979, which is quite a big thing.
It was a big thing for me, yes, indeed. One of the nice things about the Metropolitan Opera auditions, the National Council, is that when you win the audition, it gives you the options of singing auditions on every single major stage in the world that is covered by the National Council. So I chose, because of her visibility and who she was, to sing for Beverly Sills at New York City Opera. I knew that she was taking over the company in the late 1979, and that 1980 January would be her first month of performances. So I chose to sing in New York City Opera stage just right after winning the Met auditions.
Now let's backtrack a little. Where did you study?
Well, this is a funny thing. When I was a young boy, I had such awful tonsillitis, and it caused me, because of forcing sounds and things, I ended up with polyps and nodes in my cords as a little boy. So I had this awful raspy sound, and everyone in my family could sing. My mother was a music teacher and a choral conductor, and so her music and her choirs touched me. So I had a passion to study voice and to learn how to sing because of the fact that I couldn't do it so well and everyone else could. So be it. I ended up studying with my uncle, David Blackburn. David Blackburn was a student at Westminster Choir College in 1958, 59, and 60, president of the student body during that period of time, John Finley Williamson at that period of time. And so we made trips back and forth listening to these great choirs and these great singers. And so I was quite inspired.
In speaking with Mr. McFarland, he told us that he had copies of several of his performances. This is a very rare one. It was the original Metropolitan Opera audition that he sang in 1979. And in a later phone conversation, he told us something very poignant as well.
Well, this is very timely because my teacher, who was my uncle, he was a student of Sidney Dietz. That was Leonard Warren's teacher. He had taught me since I was in high school, and he actually passed away this last weekend. So it's really great for me to have the opportunity to share that. But he was an incredibly wonderful teacher. He had a wonderful instinct of how to help an artist feel relaxed and to pull the right strings to do your best at major auditions. And so he prepared me for the Met auditions in 1979, and I did win them, both in San Antonio, Texas, and then in New York City. I was the winner in 1979. He had me singing Al Pescatore from La Gioconda, which is a dramatic baritone role. Obviously, at that age, I wasn't prepared to sing as a dramatic baritone. But the aria has a bel canto quality about it that allows really beautiful singing. So the Metropolitan Opera was really happy that I had chosen it, because they felt that not only did it befit my voice, but it also released a beautiful bel canto sound. And they felt in the future I would end up singing it anyway, which I did.
Oh!
We've just heard A Pescator from the opera La Gioconda by Amilcare Ponchielli, sung by our guest today, Robert McFarland. This is a vintage recording from his private collection of his Met audition, which he sang in 1979 and was named the national winner. Now, Robert, where were you born?
I was born in Washington State, and then not long after my birth, my mother and father divorced, and so we moved back to the East Coast with my grandparents, actually in Parkersburg, West Virginia.
You have a slight something. It's not it's not Midwestern, and certainly not East Coast. So you're,
well,
but you sound like slight drawl there. Is that something?
I could probably take on a Southern drawl in a second if
okay.
I needed to.
You know, good ear. Okay, so so you studied with
David Blackburn.
David Blackburn, mm-hmm. And then what happened? How old were you when you started?
He finished his degree, and then I went to college and studied with him in my undergraduate program. But really, I wasn't so inclined to be in music. My undergrad degree was in physics. So I had an interest in religion. I was raised in a minister's home, and I was also, my father was a scientist. I had an interest in physics.
That's fascinating.
So many opera singers are not music majors, uh-huh. You know, Jerome Hines was a calculus nut and taught master classes in it. And so, I mean, you end up discovering that a lot of the colleagues you have, at least half of them, didn't go to music schools, at least with undergrad.
But it's so interesting that that's really what you followed in terms of your life's work.
It was a passionate hobby. I played trumpet professionally, actually. I studied trumpet early on, and everyone in our family, under my grandfather and my grandmother, were expected to play brass instruments. And interesting enough, in Parkersburg, that city had the national championship marching and concert band 5 years in a row. And so, I mean, brass and playing brass was a big deal there.
So you learned how to breathe anyway.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And as a trumpet player, I learned how to get back pressure on the mouthpiece where my lips would buzz, mm-hmm. and I could flex. And so I became a very good player. At that time, when I studied trumpet, I was in Cleveland, Ohio, in junior high. And I studied with Harry Herforth. And Harry was a great teacher, and in so doing, I won all these contests, and there happened to be one that would give me an opportunity to play with the Cleveland Orchestra.
Oh,
so
my.
I won it, and so I played fourth chair with Cleveland Orchestra. Here I'm sitting down in the trumpet section, and over there is Joseph Gingold, and people like this.
Goodness.
I had no idea how important
exciting.
It was.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I guess I was a musician before I was a singer.
That always helps, however. So continue.
Well, always wanted to keep studying voice, so I did. Interesting enough, I paid my way through undergrad with my trumpet scholarships. And when I took 2 years off from undergrad, I just took 2 years off to try to get my head straight and to figure out, you know. And I'm a pretty much a strong person of faith. So in my prayer life, I've felt led to become a singer. Mm-hmm. And of course, this came out of left field because my passions really weren't there. But the gift was there. And of course, Dr. Blackburn said, man, if you want to sing, you can. You have this instrument. So I just picked up, auditioned at Curtis. There was Marshall Sangier, Richard Voytok, and Margaret Harshaw. And this was in 1976. It was in May. And then Margaret Harshaw called me up. She said, you know, you were accepted here at Curtis. And I said, well, great, you know. And I thought probably I was going to go to Curtis. And then she called me back. She says, you know, Robert, we already got a baritone here that is so well-liked. And she says, I don't have one in Indiana like you. And I said, well, gee, I know about this new opera theater they've got. Let's do that. And she says, yeah. She says, you'll have to sing a couple of arias for folks when you get there. But she said, as far as I'm concerned, you're in. I said, okay. So I ended up going to Indiana University. And I ended up being associate instructor and a part-time faculty member because of the overload of majors. Now, when I did the Met auditions can be political.
But why did you even think of doing them?
Well, if I'm supposed to sing opera, then I wanted to go for it.
But at that point, I mean, did you know you wanted to sing opera?
Well, I have to tell you, in my background of faith, if that's where my calling is, I throw the things in the car and go. It's just that
way.
You
just follow what you feel. Okay.
I do. And in my prayer life, to aim at the top was the object and not question about it. So I just did that and I don't believe people do justice to themselves by measuring themselves. I really believe that in our lives we need to never measure ourselves, because people often measure themselves less than what they are. Mm-hmm. And so I don't, if I had measured myself, I wouldn't have been an international singer for sure.
In our subsequent phone conversation, Robert talked about this next aria that we're going to hear from Il Trovatore, and it's in English. That was in 1980. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I was very fortunate that Robert Larson would give me such opportunities as he did. He had a really important interest in my singing and my talent. And he offered me De Luna a year after I did my first Rigoletto there in 79. So in doing the De Luna, I felt more frightened of it probably than Rigoletto, because it required better, I think, better control in many ways. So I was very, very careful coming into it. This is the second act of Trovatore. He's coming to the convent to capture Leonora prior to her committing herself as to being a nun. And so he wants to stop this activity because, of course, he wants her. And he sings the most beautiful love song aria, I think maybe written for a baritone, Il Baleine, there at the outset. This is in 1980, Des Moines Metro Opera. I was 29 years old and still a bit nervous about letting my whole voice rest and sing in a Verdi aria.
And what is he saying here then?
Well, he talks about how beautiful she is. She's like the morning sun, and how that his heart is in rampant love with her. It's just a beautiful ballad-like song. Actually, it's much more beautiful than the tenor's ballad at the very outset of the opera. So, and it's also very much like Gounod's Valentin aria, because it shows everything good and bad about a singer.
All is deserted. They have not yet sung the hymn that starts the evening service. I've come in time then. Each reconsider, he should pack his bag. Yes, madness, but madder sane, a raging love and a jealous wounded pride forced my hand.
Once again, a vintage recording from Robert McFarlane's private collection. De Luna's aria, sung in English in a production that took place in Des Moines, Iowa in 1980. So continue. So you went and you mm-hmm. auditioned?
Well, I think humility is absolutely important in all this, because you can aim at the top and still be humble of the experience. And, you know, I'm sober at realizing on my own initiatives, I'm only this good. But given a good blessing in my life, as the scripture says, God gives a leaven, it leavens the lump. And of course, I believe in those things. So that's part of it. And so I don't take the credit. I don't think that way. So going to Indiana University, the first opera that was given to me was Falstaff. And, you know, I underestimated the piece. I mean, I'm thinking, I'm a musician, I can learn this. Mm. And I was just killing myself learning that piece. And then that happened to be our conductor was Brian Balkwell. Brian Balkwell was one of the fine conductors from Glyndebourne who had gone to Vancouver, British Columbia, and he came to Indiana University just as a guest artist, and I got to have him as my conductor. And I've got to tell you, the experience ended up being an incredible one. And, you know, having been so far behind on the experience of performing, I went to the theater department, got some help with my acting and staging, and I had a big success.
So you went, what did you sing for the Met audition?
Well, for the Met auditions, I sang A Pescatore from La Gioconda. I did that because I thought probably in my future I would be a dramatic baritone, but the piece is bel canto. So I thought, I'll sing that because it shows me off, but it shows that I'm a good musician. It shows this and that. And then I listed Largo al Factotum. Mm-hmm. I listed Ode mein Hoder ab den Stern, and I listed Di Provenza, Germont. And I listed Avant de quitter ses lieux,
which is
Valentin's aria from Faust.
you listed. Do you mean that you?
Those were the five R's.
The five
I
that
listed.
You would mm-hmm. you would be, or they just do they just choose?
They
one?
Choose what they want. And to be truthful, you get to choose the first, but they choose what they want. And by the time the audition was over, I sang everything.
Oh my!
It was
that must have been terribly exciting for you to
oh, it
win.
Was. It was fun.
So you had the world in your palm of
well,
your hand
like
at that
it, didn't
time.
It?
Yeah. So you sang for mm-hmm. Beverly Sills, and was she judging the auditions?
Actually, the first audition, the preliminary, was with Felix Popper. And Felix was this little high-pitched, Robert, would you please sing this for me? You know, and so I'm offering him what I sang, and he came up to me. And he says, "I'm going to have Beverly hear you." So I was very excited. Then I came back again and sang for Beverly, and this was in October of '79. And then you know, I gave her two resumes. I was running my career myself; I had no agent, and I think I would have been wise to probably secure an agent, but I offered her my materials, and I had a short form and a long form. And she says, well, I'm a little, we had this charming conversation. And
she was quite charming.
Oh,
wonderful.
The most charming person I can remember in my life of singing opera anywhere.
And she had a lot of difficulty also in terms
oh,
of
yeah.
being accepted by certain
oh, yeah.
parties, I know.
I think it's amazing that she was this charming and polished with all these negative
yes,
and things.
Terrible.
She
yes.
didn't.
I remember that very, very well.
Yeah.
Her struggle with the Met.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Bing and so on. We don't even go there. But in any uh-huh. case, so how long did you sing with the New York City Opera?
Up until she resigned.
Which was?
1987.
So you were there for?
7 years.
7 years.
8 years. 80, 81, 82, 83, 88 years.
And what roles did you actually do there?
Well, I did 27 roles, but to name the few that I think I did Figaro and the Barber of Seville. I was the last baritone of the Sarah Caldwell production. I sang Ford, Merry Wives of Windsor. I sang Mazzetto, and with that was early on, and of course Marcello. Mm-hmm. I sang Mazzetto with the big basses with Justino Diaz, and then of course Sam Raimi. And when they did their exchanging roles, when they did both Leporello and I was their Mazzetto. And then there was sort of this rediscovery because I was still discovering my feet on stage at that time. Instead of, you know, young singers, you notice a young singer right away when they just emote. Because that's not really what opera's about. Opera's about the specific character and the mind of that character. This is what Frank Cresaro wrote in the book Maverick. You know, he doesn't want people to show him who Carmen is or who Escamillo is. He wants people to think like they do and to become them or to pretend to be them at least and to not show them. And because
so
showing.
Acting is vitally important.
Oh,
and,
vitally important.
And getting into the character.
Yeah.
Not only musically, but
no, but being Germont, being
yes.
My first rehearsal with Frank was doing Germont, and it was with Diana Soviero, and that was my first experience in rehearsal at City Opera, as a matter of
my
fact,
goodness.
Stepping in on that one when Brent Ellis was not well at the time.
We just heard Minnie dalla mia casa from Puccini's La Fanciulla del West, sung by dramatic baritone Robert McFarlane. In our subsequent phone conversation, he told us a little bit about the production and the experience that he had doing it.
Guess who was conducting there?
I have no idea.
Well, he was 82 years old. It was Maestro Erede. I mean, this old Italian maestro that had dug so many recordings for some of the most famous singers. And when I first came there, he said, you know, Mr. McFarlane, you don't belong here. Your voice isn't the right voice. But by the time we got to production and And in performance at during the bow, the first performance, he gave me a hand to squeeze, and he says, "Yes, you are the right voice for this."
Why did he not think you were? Because you were an American baritone.
Well, yes, he considered Americans lightweights.
So
I took a period of time to convince him, and just wait and let him hear and watch. And by the time we were there, it was pretty exciting.
I bet you must always get a kick out of that when people say things that, you know, they kind of stereotype, and then you knock their socks off.
Well, you know, sometimes you're doing something, because I might go from a Donizetti piece down to something that's pretty, you know, fairly heavy, like an Iago or a Scarpia, or, you know, or a Jack Rance. And, you know, that was the case. So he felt that at the outset of rehearsals that, you know, this was a lightweight baritone.
Now back to our studio conversation with our guest today, baritone Robert McFarland. Now, did you have nerves, or did you just go and just revel in what you were doing?
Well, I had a lot of nerves to begin with. I think I was probably at New York City Opera a little too soon.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm the kind of person that pulls himself up by the bootstraps. And by 83, I was being offered almost anything you could think of. I did Slim and covered George in Mice and Men. I did Scarpia and Tosca eventually. I did Silvio's, of all things. I would do Tonio, and then I would do Silvio's. And then the last two performances that I did at New York City Opera, the next to the last was the night before, was Scarpia. And the next afternoon, I was doing Silvio.
So you were there until, what, 83?
87.
87.
Mm-hmm.
What happened after that?
Well, in 1985, really, to back up a little bit, I was international by then. I had already sung in other opera houses, and, you know, auditioning is such a strange animal. Backing up a little bit more than that, by 1982, I had been singing all these auditions and not getting work. And I pulled one of my friends who was a bass at the Met aside, and I said to him, I said, "What's wrong?" And he says, "Why do you think that all these people you sing for, you know what you are?" He says, "Most of these people have never studied voice, Robert." He says, "You sing well, but," he said, "when you audition, what do you wear?" And I thought, gee, I wear that Neiman Marcus blazer, and and I wear that white shirt and my gray pants and wingtip shoes. And he says, "That's non-distinct. He says, "You have to give them, help spell it out for them, because most of these people aren't that smart about what you are. You have to help them." So I went out and bought this black Phoenix Mafia suit, you know, and a vest and a white shirt, open collar, and put on my metal silver pipe, put on a silver choke, you know, chain. And I curled my hair. And little did I know my hair was already curly, because I didn't ever let it grow that long. But I curled my hair, grew this Shakespearean beard, and I started singing more Verdi.
Well, actually, for the audience, you still are very dramatic looking, and you still have that Shakespearean beard,
yeah.
And it is very, very interesting and attractive.
Thank you. I need help there.
Yeah.
Well, all of a sudden, I'm having fun in auditions, and everybody says, "You know, I've discovered that Robert's this Verdi baritone he's singing for, but we're going to try him out in Trovatore." In 1982, I had 6 productions of Trovatore in the same year. And I mean... all of a sudden, I was discovered from 1983 through 1989, almost out of 10 auditions, I was getting 8 and 9 job offers in 10 auditions. And it's because I was at peace with myself. I was enjoying what I was doing, and I discovered
who you are as well.
Singing as a singer, auditioning is really more playing a shrink than it is being needy. And I wasn't needy anymore. And I realized that I needed to help them feel good and help them feel fine, and how are they today, and making sure that they are, you know, happy about the experience, and they didn't forget it. Pretty soon, I remember singing for Abbado one day, and Abbado wanted to hear me sing Pagliacci, and so it was a horrible day. I had a third chord of mucus. I sounded like Kenny Rogers on an A flat, and so it just got worse and worse, and I stopped. I said, "You know, I've got this." He says, "Yeah, I hear it. And we were at Studio 58, and that's like all these artists sitting in the other room there through the curtain. And it just got worse. By the time I finished the aria, it was like a 3 different voices singing the A flat. And I just had this confidence. I said, "Well, there it is." He hired me. And of course, walking out
there,
those guys said, you know, they said, "Gee, Robert, it's a bad day." I said, "Is it? Could it be worse?"
So, but you just kept going.
Yeah.
Robert McFarland in a 1989 production in Salt Lake City of Pagliacci by Leon Cavallo. That was the prologue, sung, of course, by Tonio. So wonderful, wonderful beginning, wonderful achievement, and here you are, and you've got the world at your feet, essentially, as a career. Then what happened?
Well, I think I went to Glyndebourne in 1988. I was at Houston in 1985. Valentin was the major role that was pivotal for me. Usually the Verdi baritones that really sing the Valentin aria and the role in a big, big house. And I sang that in Jones Hall. And then in the next year, we opened the Wortham Theater with Aida, and I got a chance to sing with
Aida. Well, yes, what I wanted also you to explain to the audience, of course, we have a lot of opera lovers listening, but you're a dramatic baritone, and it's not the heroic tenor that we're always, ooing and eyeing over, but of course the voice is so terribly, terribly rich and important.
Yes.
So that the roles are usually... they're not secondary, but they are not the hero roles.
No, they're the pivotal, usually pivotal
very
nemesis.
Dramatic. Yes, yes,
dramatic.
Yes, yes.
I was in Italy there in La Scala, and they were asking me on the radio station, what is it you draw from, for this role of Iago? And I'm thinking I said, well, I watched the trials of Ted Bundy and certain these murders and psychopaths. And I'm thinking there's nothing in my, this is an opportunity to do a study on someone.
But it is. It's a very rich character study. So, okay, here you are. What happened?
Well, I think people, Houston Grand Opera played a pivotal role. I got a chance to do 12 major operas in 10 years down there. And some of them knew. I backing up before then, back to even in the late 70s through the early 80s, Robert Larson played a major role in my life because he had me doing lyric things to the dramatic things. He heard in my voice these things. And I did Iago there. I did Pagliacci there. But I also did Lucia there. And I also did Marcello there. And I also did things like
but
that.
But the life of a singer, I mean, it is so important to be in good shape at the right place, and it's the window of time is really not that big, because some of the unusual singers who are still singing and they're much older, someone like Domingo or someone like that, but it's very unusual. But I really don't think they, because the voice changes. So what happened after all of this success? Because your life changed very dramatically.
Something major comes to mind here when you mentioned Placido, because he was a close friend of mine, and we worked together a lot, not in Houston, but also in Portugal and et cetera. I think the pivotal thing in my career, the ups and downs of my career, are associated with my personal life. Absolutely personal life. I am a person that, when I go to a performance, if I'm not touched or somebody doesn't move me, unless it's a pretentious role, like if it's Adele or something like that. But I mean, if it were something, like Rigoletto, any one of the roles in Rigoletto, I like to be moved by. Even in Spada Vocile, I like to hear that soul of a man who's honest in his murderous way. Mm-hmm. That really drives home things. And I think the ups and downs of my career are directly associated with my personal life, because, early on, I was married to my high school sweetheart, but she left because she really hated being associated with the business of opera. And I lost my wife and two daughters just from that.
Well, you traveled probably a lot, too.
Well, I took them with me, but she just wanted no part of it. Mm-hmm. And that was hard. And then when I married the second time, I've been married three times here. I married the second time. I was trying to learn on the way. I married someone who was a very dear person, but I think she had a jealousy as to what I was doing, and there were these fireworks constantly, and I was often threatened of divorce the night before an opening. I mean, that happened so many times, and these kind of things throw a wrench. I mean, my opening of the Deutsche Opera of Iago at their Richard Wagnerstrasse in Berlin, that was how that happened.
And it impacts on your
performance. I didn't sleep all night.
But Robert McFarlane continued to perform. Here he is in a 1994 production in Nice, France, of Tosca by Puccini. Here is the recitative a Pui Forte Sapore, sung by Scarpia, a recording from his private collection. We just heard a Pui Forte Sapore from Tosca by Puccini, sung by baritone Robert McFarland.
One of the nice things that happened probably since 1995 has been because up in there were these turmoil moments and uneven places in my singing. I was able to sing, but it wasn't with such potency at times because there was a lack of rest and things, and like Mel Torme says, rest is the most single important thing in a singer's life. So having come to peace with myself, and now I've remarried and I adopted three little boys and we've had another boy and a little girl, I can't tell you what a stabilizing thing this was for me. I married my best friend and all these kind of things. So I'm having the best time of my life right now because of that stability.
Are you singing a lot?
Well, up until 2003, I think from 1995 to 2003, I did 12 brand new operas, and I was busy singing all the time, but I had to put the brakes on there for my health in 2003.
Because that was quite a shock.
Well, I had a little cancer issue, and in 1990, I went to see an orthopedic surgeon because I felt something funny in my right hip, and I had lifted a piano. And I was carrying one end of it and by myself, and I felt something give in 1990. And so the doctor in 94, he said to me, here in Philadelphia, by the way, he said, Robert, you're going to have that replaced. And I'm going to see you in 10 years. Sure enough, it was about 10 years later, I had to replace my right hip because I did some damage. But on top of that, I had a skin cancer issue. And I had to stop the whole show for a while and deal with something that was quite serious.
And now, happily?
Happily, it's gone.
Now, you're very involved as well in your own, is it your own opera company?
Well, I had noticed, and I even sat down with Beverly Sills in 1998. We sat down and chatted about a serious situation in the United States. You know, in the 1970s and 80s, companies like Des Moines, Central City, Chautauqua, yes, Sarasota, even Santa Fe back then in the 70s was always providing a major role for a up-and-coming young singer who didn't have experience. Eventually, all those companies became known as only hiring veterans.
Yes, major
yeah,
opera companies.
And no longer the young singer, right? I mean, Robert Larson, Leonard Trish, they hired me at Indiana University. And I had not that much experience, but they hired me. I mean, Leonard Trish hired me for Figaro and Barbara Seville. And Robert hired me for I did 9 major roles for Robert in 6 years.
I think that what happened, it used to be that you'd have to go to Europe to get your
yes,
sea legs, as it were.
Yeah, and a fast contract.
So you had decided. Did you make a decision to
do this?
We
made a decision together. Beverly Sills, she said, Robert, what do you think about running an opera company? And I thought, well, what? She says, no, your personality is.
Goodness. So what is the opera company? What is the name of it?
Opera Seabrook. Opera Seabrook is a company that's down in South Jersey. And it sort of was tossed in my lap because there was a need for artists who live in that Delaware,
that's
South
where
Jersey
the Seabrook
region.
Farms are, were down
Seabrook
there.
Seabrook Farms.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And we basically borrowed the name because it has sort of a national feeling and it has that kind of Chautauqua, Vizcaya feeling to it, you know. And so we just said, you know, look, we'll do this on a volunteer basis, and people have been coming out of the woodwork to do this and volunteer.
And what about your audiences?
We did our first concert June 25th, and the small papers in the Southern Jersey advertised it, and we had a crowd of people having been turned away at this concert version of what we were planning to do in October 17th and 19th is our Pagliacci, and we're planning to do that. We hope to be doing it at the Salem Community College. We have four productions this year. We have a Pagliacci in the fall in October there. Then we're going to be doing All the Night Visitors there in the beginning of December. That would be December 10th and 14th. And then we're going to be doing the Magic Flute in English. It's really hopefully for the kids and children. We're doing that in the third week of January, or fourth week, actually third and fourth week of January. And then in the last week of April, we're performing Rigoletto.
The burning question, are you singing as part of them, or are you getting other artists in?
Well, you know, I hadn't sung since 2003. I was in England singing there, and I stopped a career after doing Traviata to do my health. Mm-hmm. And an opportunity came to me, one of my young artists that I represent and help them get, you know, for auditions and things with McFarlane Artists, because I have an agency that I represent artists trying to help these up and coming artists who would not be heard, normally. Well, she started an opera company in the Italian district of St. Louis. Her family had been there for years, and she did a bang up job. The place was packed, and, they had, three performances, and they were all packed out. She asked me if I would direct and perform Rigoletto. And so this was in conjunction with Scott Schoonover of Union Avenue Opera there, which is doing quite well in St. Louis. So I went over there, and I don't know how smart this was, but I mean, to direct it and then sing in it, and hadn't been singing for a while, but it went so well. She did a great job. The artists were fantastic. The people were screaming on their feet, and I had the best time singing again, Rigoletto.
So you did start to sing.
Yeah,
again.
I went back to singing, and so I'll be back singing again. I'll be performing with Delaware County Symphony.
And what are you going to be doing?
We're going to be doing Wagner, A Night of Wagner, in early December. I'll be doing the Dutchman aria and Fidelio, the Ach, welchen Augenblick. From Fidelio.
How does it feel to sing again?
Oh, I love singing.
Well, you are amazing because you have so much enthusiasm and so much verve, and you've been through a very terrible ordeal, and to keep going and to be creative, and I just think it's amazing. And it's been really a wonderful pleasure to speak with you. You had some amazing experiences, and you look great.
Thank you.
And we certainly champion your new efforts and the opera company.
Well, I thank the good Lord for allowing me to sing in almost every major opera theater in the world.
You've still got a lot ahead of you.
I think so. I think that that's what I'm planning to do, and we're trying to plan how to enter in that way again in a wise way, and maybe do three and four productions a year and do those choice pieces like Scarpia and Iago and Rigoletto and Trovatore and things like that, you know.
Now, if anyone wants to have tickets for these, is there a season ticket that you can get?
Yes, they would want to call my office, which is here in Philadelphia, and my assistant, who is just a genius and a wonderful singer, Patrizia Stella Patino. And that number would be 267-918-9752.
Robert McFarland, the very best to you. Will, we're going to follow you around.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming to Crossover and sharing with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And now, from a performance done in 2008 in St. Louis, Robert McFarland singing the aria Cortigiani from Rigoletto.